A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a live wire. J.D. Vance, the vice president who wrote a memoir about clawing his way out of Appalachian poverty, has become the most unpredictable voice in American Middle East policy. He tells AIPA behind closed doors that Israel can't kill its way out of a war. 2 days later, Iran violates the nuclear monitoring agreement, and he tweets that violence will be met with violence. Same man, same week, completely different registers. And Daniel's question is essentially, what's the lens here? What does Vance's origin story, Kentucky, Jackson, the broken home, the memoir, tell us about how he sees this war and why he seems almost naive about taking Iranian commitments at their word?
The contradiction is the whole story, right? Because if you just read the headlines, you'd think this guy doesn't know what he believes. He's simultaneously the most pro-Israel voice in Trump's inner circle and the most willing to publicly dress them down. He says the United States is Israel's only friend left, which is a profound statement of solidarity, and then in the same month, he's telling them their entire military strategy is a dead end. Most people look at that and see incoherence. I think they're missing what's actually coherent about it.
The timing makes this more than an academic exercise. Iran breached the monitoring MOU on July 1st, enriching to 84% in Fordo. The Rubio camp at State put out a statement about coordinated responses and the IAEA framework. Vance just tweeted, "No process, no interagency review, just his phone and a threat." So we've got two men, both with the president's ear, operating from completely different playbooks, and Israel is reportedly asking which voice actually speaks for the United States.
Which is an alarming question for an ally to be asking in the middle of a shooting war. So Daniel's instinct to look at the background, at the memoir, at where this guy came from, I think that's exactly the right move. Because Vance's foreign policy instincts don't come from the Council on Foreign Relations or a Senate committee. They come from a specific place and a specific culture. A world where institutions had failed so completely and so repeatedly that the only currency left was personal loyalty and credible threat.
That's the arc we want to trace. From a kid watching his community collapse around him in the Rust Belt and Appalachia, to the vice president in the Oval Office telling the most powerful nation in the Middle East that it can't bomb its way to victory, while threatening the regime in Tehran with violence if it breaks another promise. The through line isn't politics, it's a worldview. And if you don't understand the worldview, the statements look contradictory. If you do, they're almost inevitable.
We should say up front, this isn't a biography episode. We're not doing a book report on hillbilly elegy. What we're interested in is the mechanism. How does a specific upbringing produce a specific way of seeing trust, betrayal, loyalty, and violence? And what happens when that way of seeing gets applied to a part of the world where trust is already the scarcest resource?
The question hanging over all of this is whether a man who learned to survive by distrusting every institution he ever encountered can navigate a conflict where the other side has spent 4 decades perfecting institutional deception, and whether the honor code that got him out of Kentucky is the same one that could get us into a war.
That's the puzzle Daniel put in front of us. Vance is, at the same time, the most pro-Israel voice in the administration, and the one most willing to call them out in public. He tells AIPAC behind closed doors that you can't kill your way out of a war. Then, Iran violates the MOU, and within hours, he's threatening violence. Most commentators look at that and say, this guy is out of his depth, he's contradictory, he doesn't know what he's doing.
Which is the easy read. But it doesn't explain why the statements feel internally consistent to him. Nobody walks around thinking they're incoherent.
And that's what makes this worth digging into. Because what looks like contradiction from the outside is often just a coherent worldview you haven't mapped yet. Vance grew up in a culture where institutions, government, police, the media, had burned his community so many times that the only thing that mattered was personal credibility. You keep your word, or you're nothing. And if someone breaks their word to you, the only language they understand is consequence.
When he looks at Iran, he's not seeing a nation-state with a complex diplomatic history. He's seeing a liar. And when he looks at Israel, he's seeing a friend who's making a tactical mistake. Those two positions aren't in tension if your framework is loyalty and credibility, rather than, say, multilateral diplomacy and calibrated signaling.
And that's the lens we want to trace here. We're going to start with where he came from, Jackson, Kentucky, Middletown, Ohio, the world hillbilly elegy describes, because you can't understand the foreign policy until you understand the cultural operating system. Then we map that onto what he's actually saying about Iran and Israel. Then we look at the Rubio rivalry, because that's where the worldview collides with the machinery of state. And finally, we ask the uncomfortable question, what happens when a guy who learned to survive by never trusting institutions sits across the table, metaphorically, from a regime that has spent 45 years perfecting institutional deception?
The regime lies as a matter of statecraft, and he responds to lies with ultimatums. That's either the most dangerous possible combination, or the only thing Tehran actually understands. And which one it is depends entirely on whether you think the honor code translates.
Let's go to Jackson, Kentucky. Summers with his grandparents, Mama and Papa. And the thing about Hillbilly Elegy that most people miss is that it's not really a policy book. It's an ethnography of broken trust. Vance describes a community where calling the police was considered a betrayal of your own family. His grandmother had a rule. If someone crosses you, you don't call the cops. You handle it yourself. That wasn't posturing. That was survival logic in a place where the institutions had either abandoned you or actively made things worse.
The context for that matters. This is an abstract anti-government sentiment. Middletown, Ohio, in the 80s and 90s, had watched its steel jobs evaporate. Jackson, Kentucky, had been poor for generations. The opioid crisis rolled through both places like a slow-motion hurricane. His own mother cycled through addiction, rehab, relapse. The one constant was Mama, who kept a loaded gun and a code. You protect your own, and you never let a slight go unanswered.
There's a passage in the memoir where he talks about the emotional logic of the place. He says something like, "We don't just not trust institutions. We actively despise them because they've earned our contempt." And that's a crucial distinction. It's not ignorance. It's a learned response to repeated betrayal. When the steel mill closes and nobody in Washington seems to notice, when the pharmacy on the corner is suddenly a pill mill and the DEA shows up 5 years too late, you develop a pretty specific theory of how the world works.
The theory being promises are the only thing that matter, and the only way to enforce a promise is through personal consequence, not through a system, not through a process.
That's the honor culture piece. Sociologists who study Appalachia describe it as a classic honor culture, similar in some ways to what you see in parts of the Middle East or the Mediterranean. When formal institutions can't be relied on for justice, reputation and retaliation become the enforcement mechanism. You don't start fights, but you finish them. You don't bluff. Because if you bluff and get called on it, you've lost the only thing protecting you.
Which is why Vance's tweet about Iran wasn't, "We are reviewing our options," or "We are consulting with allies." It was, "Violence will be met with violence. The United States does not bluff." That sentence could have come straight out of Mama's kitchen.
It landed completely differently than Rubio's statement, which came out the same day through State Department channels. Rubio talked about the IAEA, about coordinating with European partners, about a measured response. That's the language of someone who came up through the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where you learn that diplomacy is a game of calibrated signals and multilateral frameworks. You don't say exactly what you mean because ambiguity is a tool.
Rubio's entire career has been about working the levers of institutional power. He was the youngest speaker of the Florida House, then a senator, then Secretary of State. His worldview assumes institutions work, or at least can be made to work. Vance assumes they don't. So when Rubio sees an Iranian violation, he sees a problem for the IAEA board. When Vance sees it, he sees a liar who needs to be reminded that consequences are real.
Here's where the memoir becomes a political Rorschach test, which is part of what Daniel's getting at. When Hillbilly Elegy came out in 2016, it spent over 80 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. Liberals read it and said, "Look at this devastating portrait of systemic failure. These people need investment, health care, a social safety net." Conservatives read it and said, "Look at this proof that personal responsibility and family values are what actually lift people out of poverty." Both sides were using the same text to argue completely opposite things.
Vance himself, over time, leaned hard into the second interpretation. The book ends with him crediting his grandmother's toughness, the Marine Corps, and his own choices for his escape. Not a government program. Not a policy intervention. The lesson he took from his own life is that systems don't save you. You save yourself. And if you extend that logic to foreign policy, you get a very specific approach to allies and adversaries.
Allies are like family. You're loyal to them even when you think they're making a mistake, and you tell them they're making a mistake because that's what family does. Adversaries are people who've broken their word, and the only thing they understand is consequence. This isn't a complicated framework. It has about 3 moving parts. But it explains everything he said about Israel and Iran in the last 2 months.
The question that hangs over it, and we'll get to this, is whether it works when the adversary isn't a neighbor who stole your truck, but a regime that has spent 45 years treating deception as a legitimate instrument of statecraft. Mamma's code assumes the other guy is operating by roughly the same rules. Tehran isn't.
Let's apply this directly to the statements that have everyone confused. Start with the AIPAC meeting in May. Vance tells them, you can't kill your way out of a war. Now, if you're coming from the foreign policy establishment, you hear that and think, is this guy going soft on Israel's right to defend itself? But that's not what he's saying at all. He's saying, I'm loyal to you, and because I'm loyal, I'm going to tell you the truth you don't want to hear. That's Mama at the kitchen table. That's not a policy critique. That's family.
The only friend left line from the Palm Beach fundraiser in June. That's the other side of the same coin. He's telling a room full of donors. The UN is hostile, Europe is unreliable, the international community has abandoned you. But we haven't. We're the ones who show up. That is pure in-group, out-group thinking from a man who grew up believing the federal government was basically an occupying force. Now he is the federal government, but the mental model hasn't changed. Israel is us. Everyone else is them.
You can see how this would land differently in Jerusalem than a standard diplomatic reassurance. Rubio would say, we value our strategic partnership and remain committed to Israel's qualitative military edge. Vance says, everyone else has bailed on you, but we're still here. One sounds like a treaty, the other sounds like a blood oath. And for a country that's been fighting on multiple fronts, a blood oath lands harder.
Then July 1st happens. Iran breaches the MOU at Fordo, enriching to 84%. And Vance doesn't consult, doesn't convene a principals meeting, doesn't wait for the intelligence community assessment. Violence will be met with violence. The United States does not bluff. And suddenly, the blood oath language isn't about reassurance anymore. It's about escalation.
This is where the honor culture framework makes everything legible. In Vance's world, diplomacy isn't a process. It's a test of credibility. You make an agreement. The other side either keeps it or they don't. If they don't, you have exactly 2 choices. You can enforce a consequence, or you could admit that your word means nothing. There is no third option. There's no, we're reviewing the situation. There's no, all options remain on the table. That kind of language, to him, is just cowardice dressed up in a suit.
Rubio's statement the same day was basically the opposite. Coordinate with European allies. That's the institutionalist playbook. You use the violation to build a coalition. You isolate Iran diplomatically. You make the cost gradual and multilateral. Vance hears that, and probably thinks it sounds like asking the people who failed you for permission to defend yourself.
Now we get to the practical consequence. Israel is in the middle of a war, and they're reportedly reading diplomatic cables that say, essentially, we don't know which voice speaks for the United States. That's not a hypothetical. That's a real problem, because if you're making military decisions based on what you think the American posture is, and the American posture depends on which advisor had the last word with the president, you're operating in the dark.
Trump's decision-making style amplifies this. He doesn't resolve the tension between Vance and Rubio. He lets it play out. He listens to whoever is in the room, whoever sounds toughest in the moment. So the policy becomes a function of proximity, not strategy. If Vance is at Mar-a-Lago when the next crisis hits, the response looks one way. If Rubio is at state running a process, it looks completely different.
The knock-on effect is maximum uncertainty with minimum deterrence. Iran knows there are two voices. They know one wants to coordinate with the IAEA and one wants to meet violence with violence, so they test both. They push the envelope, see which response they get, and calibrate accordingly. Meanwhile, Israel can't plan around American red lines because the red lines move depending on who's standing next to the president.
Here's the thing about deterrence. It only works if the other side believes your threat is credible and consistent. Right now, Tehran doesn't know which America they're dealing with on any given day. That's not a strong position. It's chaos with nuclear weapons in the background.
Where does this leave us? Two advisors, two completely different operating systems, one president who decides based on who's in the room. And here's the thing I think most coverage gets wrong. The narrative is that Vance is simply unqualified, out of his depth, naive. But that's not quite right. He is qualified by a different standard. The question is whether that standard works when the guy across the table isn't a neighbor who stole your truck, but a regime that treats deception as statecraft.
This is the mismatch that Daniel's really pointing at. Vance assumes Iran operates by the same honor code he grew up with. You break a promise, you get hit. But Iran doesn't play by those rules. They have a different operating system entirely. Taqiya, strategic dissimulation, has been a sanctioned practice in Shia Islam for centuries. Saving face while advancing your position incrementally, that's not a bug in their system. It's the whole design.
He's playing chess with someone who's playing Go. In chess, the board is transparent, the moves are visible, and a broken rule ends the game. In Go, you surround slowly, you create ambiguity about your intentions, and the board is deliberately hard to read. Vance keeps looking for the moment when Iran clearly violated the terms so he can respond. Iran keeps making sure there's never quite a clean moment. There's always a plausible reading where they didn't technically break the agreement, they just reinterpreted it.
That's the structural flaw, not just in Vance, but in the whole process. You've got two people with fundamentally different worldviews giving the president competing advice, and the president's decision-making is reactive, not strategic. So the policy isn't a policy. It's whoever had the last word.
Which means the single most useful thing anyone could do, if they're trying to predict what the United States will actually do in the next crisis, is follow the proximity signal. Who was with Trump when the news broke? If Vance is at Mar-a-Lago, expect the honor code response. Direct, personal, escalatory. If Rubio is at state running a principals meeting, expect the institutionalist response. IAEA, allies, calibrated language.
It sounds almost absurdly simple, but that's where we are. The most powerful military in the world, and its posture toward a nuclear threshold state, depends on which advisor got the last 15 minutes with the president. That's not a foreign policy. That's a scheduling problem with nuclear stakes.
The question that's going to define the next crisis, and Daniel's really putting his finger on it here, is whether a man who learned to survive by never trusting institutions can learn to read a regime that has spent 45 years perfecting institutional deception. Vance's whole framework depends on being able to spot the moment when someone breaks their word. But what if the other side never gives you a clean break to spot?
That's the trap. Tehran doesn't hand you an unambiguous violation with a bow on it. They give you 84% enrichment and a technical briefing about how it's for medical isotopes. They give you a monitoring breach and a diplomatic note saying it was a scheduling error. Every violation comes with a plausible reading attached, and the plausible reading is the weapon. It forces you into their game. Either you accept the fiction, which makes you look weak, or you reject it, which makes you look like you were looking for a fight.
For Vance, that's an intolerable position. His entire operating system rejects ambiguity. You broke your word or you didn't. If you did, there are consequences. But Iran's been playing this game since 1979, and they're very good at it. They know that the American who demands clarity is the American they can bait into overreaching.
The next crisis isn't really about centrifuges or enrichment levels. It's a test of which worldview wins. Vance's personalist honor code, where a broken promise triggers immediate retaliation, or Rubio's institutionalist statecraft, where violations are managed through frameworks and coalitions. And the outcome of that test is going to define American Middle East policy for the rest of the decade.
Because here's the thing. If Vance's approach works, if Iran actually backs down in the face of an unambiguous threat, then the institutionalists look like they've been playing a game that Tehran was never playing in good faith. But if it fails, if the honor code leads to a confrontation that no one in the establishment wanted, then we're in a war that started not because of a strategic calculation, but because a worldview couldn't accommodate the ambiguity it was facing.
That's the open question we can't answer yet. We're watching it unfold in real time. The story isn't finished.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The earliest known Ottoman manuscript documenting the rules of Yagli Gurek, Turkish oil wrestling, dates to the early 1500s and specifies that wrestlers must be anointed with olive oil by a designated kazgar before each match, a ritual the text describes as the anointing of brothers before the struggle.
I have so many questions, and I'm not sure I want any of them answered.
A lot of olive oil.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. If you want to send us your own prompt the way Daniel does, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We read everything.
If this episode gave you a framework you didn't have before, tell someone about the show. Word of mouth is how we grow. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.